We continue again this evening in our studies in Ecclesiastes that we've been looking at now for the past number of months. And we're coming to the closing chapters, 11 and 12. And as I indicated at the reading, these chapters, in a sense, they overlap and they do form a kind of conclusion to the whole of the sermon or the sermons that the preacher has been preaching to us. And we have looked through the book up to chapter 10 thus far, sometimes taking whole chapters, sometimes half a chapter at a time. But we have seen the meanderings of his thought, how he is commenting on life under the sun, and vanity is marked in everything, in every life that is lived under the sun. And in order to be delivered from a vanity of living, we must live, as it were, with our affections set above the light of the sun. And last Wednesday we were looking in chapter 10, and we were making the comment that this chapter 10 really could be taken straight out of the book of Proverbs. It's a whole series of Proverbs. And we did gather some of them together, and we saw that the preacher is returning to familiar themes in chapter 10, as he has been doing so throughout the book. Foolishness and wisdom are contrasted. The way of the foolish man is evident to everybody, the way he speaks, the way he acts. You can tell immediately whether he's a fool or a wise man. And the wise man, he speaks and acts in a certain kind of way. The preacher reminds us of our attitudes towards rulers. And it may well be that there are some rulers who are totally unfit for their office, but nonetheless we're to give them a due regard for the office, not to the man. It's like in the military forces when an enlisted soldier or sailor or whatever sees a commissioned officer coming, he salutes. The man that he is saluting may well be totally unworthy of any kind of recognition or deference, but the man is saluting the rank, not the man. It's the same principle that we find in the scripture. We give honor to whom honor is due because of the place they occupy, not according to their character. And that's the basic principle of the scripture. So we're looking at that kind of thing last Wednesday. And we come now to the 11th chapter. Matthew Poole, in his commentary on Ecclesiastes, tells us that at the end of chapter 10, he says, we are given our duty to our superiors. And in the opening verses of chapter 11, he says we are then given our duties towards our inferiors. He may well be right. I'm not going to argue with the good man. Whether that is what the preacher intends or not, I wouldn't know. But certainly Matthew Poole is of the mind that there is this deliberate contrast, and he may well be right. But it does remind us, of course, of our catechisms and confessions, our duties to superiors and to inferiors. So it's a good way of thinking about these kinds of issues. Well, anyway, we come to the 11th chapter. I was considering taking both of these chapters, half a chapter at a time. I may do so next time with chapter 12. I may take it in two parts on two separate occasions. I have not decided that yet. But I'm going to take the whole of chapter 11, even although it could well be spread over two Wednesdays. I don't want to prolong this study over much. And we've already been, 15 or 16 sermons into the book, as far as I know. So we're going to take the whole chapter. Now, the chapter is a brief chapter. It's only 10 verses. And it divides very neatly and obviously into two parts. Verses 1 to 6 form the first half of the chapter. And the general heading that we could give to this first part is, I suppose, something like, do good while you can, while you have opportunities. Do the best you can in the time available to do it, because time is passing and opportunities fly away. That basically is what these opening six verses are teaching. And then verses 7 to 10, again, we're reminded of life in general. And life is not just to be endured and put up with. The writer has been telling us how life can be very difficult unjust and unfair, and the poor are ill-treated and downtrodden by the rich. The wise people in low places are not always given the recognition. He's already told us the battle is not always to the strong, the race is not always to the swift. Time and chance happens to them all. Those who are deserving sometimes don't get the recognition that they deserve. Those who are undeserving sometimes take all the rewards and all the kudos and all that is desirable. And that's the kind of world we live in. But nonetheless, we have noticed throughout the book that the writer is saying, well, life can be enjoyable despite the fact that it's full of injustices. Death comes in the end, and life is brief and uncertain. Nonetheless, life is not meant to be lived miserably. Life can be a very sweet and a very enjoyable thing. Truly, the light is sweet, and a pleasant thing it is for the eyes to behold the sun. So let's not live gloomy lives and be so serious and downcast over sin and these issues that we forget that there is such a thing as mercy and salvation and heaven for those who believe. So these are the two sections that this chapter is dealing with. First of all, take opportunities to do good and recognize that now is the time. Anything that's going to be done must be done now. What must be done tis best done quickly. You remember Shakespeare's famous words in Macbeth. And then life can be very pleasant, and especially time of youth. So let's look then at these verses. The first section opens with this rather strange exhortation, or exhortations. Cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days. Give a portion to seven and also to eight, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. Now, many a sermon has been preached on these words, especially verse 1, cast thy bread upon the waters. And it's, of course, a very good text for a sermon. And it's possible to amplify and to spiritualize the text into all kinds of possible ramifications. And the scholars do have differences of opinion as to what the preacher is actually referring to here. There are some who go into great detail about the rising of the flood on the Nile, for example, and how it seems to have been a practice among the ancient Egyptians, possibly the modern Egyptians for all I know, that at the flooding of the Nile period, although it doesn't flood so regularly now because of those dams that they built further up or further down, actually, the Nile. But the point is, in ancient times, the land of Egypt depended entirely upon the flooding of the Nile. And you may well be far away from the bank of the Nile, from the actual bank, but in flood the water would spread on either side to the east and the west, and it would fertilize, it would water the ground, and you could be quite far away living from the actual river, and you would sprinkle your crops knowing that the waters of the flood were going to come, and even when they receded there would still be the moisture in the soil sufficient to germinate the crops. Now, there are those who take that view, and apparently from the satellites, so we understand, you can see a picture of Egypt, and you can see the Nile, and you can see the green verdure of the Nile against the rather ochreish yellow-grey of the desert on either side. So this is a possible picture that the preacher has, and not only to the Nile, but any flood plain, the alluvial soil, as we know, is a very rich soil. And so the picture here is of casting, actually casting bread, casting a seed, because the word here used for bread can also be used for seed. And so that's a possible picture, and I'm not going to argue with that. But I think that there's a wider application than that. It doesn't apply only to the casting of seed, literally. All kinds of good fruits come from all kinds of good deeds. And everything that you and I do in life, in a sense, is going to bear fruit in some way. Either for good or for ill, everything we do, we are sowing a crop of some kind or other. Whatever a man sows, that shall he also reap. So it applies, of course, physically in the agricultural sphere, but also applies doctrinally, it applies morally, it applies with the efforts that we put into life. And basically what the principle is cast your bread, put your seed down, live in a manner that is going to be fruitful in the end. Because, he says, you're going to find it back when you, as it were, give yourself out or give of your possessions. And again, the commentators, several of them, make the point of giving away your money, for example. The miser hoards what he has because he's afraid of losing it. Whereas the generous man, he gives freely. And whether he loses it or not is not a consideration. He gives because he recognizes it's a good thing to do. But what the generous man finds is that he is often not the loser. The miser who hoards and lives, say, only to accumulate and to hold on to his possessions, finds himself increasingly narrowed down in life. He finds himself increasingly isolated. And he finds, to his surprise maybe, that people don't like him very much. And they don't share with him. He's not invited to the happy occasions because he's a miser and he casts a kind of sad gloom wherever he goes. Whereas the individual who is gregarious and outgoing and generous, that individual gets many rewards in return for his generosity. Just as the man who sows his seed, he is going to get a good harvest in the end. So it's like that with life generally. And the picture is, therefore, of living a life that is like a sower going forth to sow his seed, because you are going to find it back. And you will find, perhaps, that you get more than you ever imagined when you were sowing your seed. Perhaps you were sowing with the hope that you might get some return. And you might get 30-fold, 60-fold, 100-fold return. That's the picture. If you would be generous, then generosity will come your way. Even the world has a little proverb that what goes out comes round. What goes round comes round. And you find maybe sometime later on in life that you are rewarded in an unexpected way with some pleasant gift or some pleasant commendation or a recommendation or an opportunity in life is opened because of something that you've done in the past, and someone remembers it and recognizes it, and now they're going to return the favor. That's the general picture that this opening statement surely has in mind. Cast thy bread upon the water, whatever the bread is, be generous with it, and you will find that life will be bountiful, and you will find it again after many days. It may be that you don't find it immediately. Maybe there is a delay, but there is going to be some return. It may even be in heaven, where, as Jesus, you remember, speaks of giving the cup of cold water and doing those things that are normative to the Christian life. But he remembers it, visiting the sick, supplying clothing and food for the needy and so on. And it comes back to us as a reward. He remembers, and we find ourselves pleasantly surprised that such a thing was even considered as worthy of some kind of remuneration. And so this is the picture that we have here. It could apply to preachers of the gospel and to spreading the seed of the gospel. Sometimes I think we are too hasty to pass judgments upon our own ministry or our own effectiveness as Christian witnesses, just because we don't see people flocking into the churches or conversions multiplying almost on a regular basis. We may imagine that we're wasting our time. Maybe we are. But we are surely encouraged in the scriptures to remember that we are not, because good seed, if it is good seed that we are sowing, it will always bear good fruit. Good seed and good fruit go together. Whatever a man sows, that is what he's going to reap. And those who reap in tears will return with joy, gathering their sheaves, as the psalmist reminds us. So sometimes we have to labor on and cast our bread again and again upon many waters. But if it is good, if it is for God's glory and for the good of people, then it will never, never be something that is wasted seed. It will always return and produce some good thing after many days, perhaps. But nonetheless, good seed produces good fruit. That's the picture. And notice the generosity that is spoken of here. Give a portion to seven and also to eight. Now, seven in the Bible is a complete number. And so if we take this in its symbolic as well as in its literal meaning, it could mean give as much as you can and then give more than you can, so to speak. To give seven is to give a complete number. Give eight. Go beyond what would be regarded as much as you can give. Be extra generous. And the Apostle Paul, you remember, speaks in 2 Corinthians of those Christians who gave beyond their means. They didn't just give the tithe and then left it at the tithe. They gave more than what would have been regarded as a sufficient generosity. Give a portion to seven and also to eight, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. Who knows what the future holds? Do good while you have the opportunity, because the evil days may come when you don't have the opportunity anymore. I often think of that great story in the book of Genesis. Joseph, you remember, when he was the chamberlain or the chief cashier or whatever his title would be in Egypt, when he was in charge of the treasury and he was in charge of the distribution of the food sources for the Egyptian nation, it seems. And you remember there were those seven rich years. And in those rich years, Joseph knew from a dream, a prophecy, that there, after the rich 7 years, there was going to be 7 years of famine. And during those rich years, Joseph stored up in the storehouses all the grain. Nothing of it was wasted. So that when the years of famine came, there was food in Egypt to be distributed fairly, but nonetheless there was nourishment. And it seems to me that there is a principle here, and it applies to our lives. It applies to the preaching of the gospel. While you've got an opportunity to do it, because tomorrow the opportunity may be gone forever. We all know, don't we, from our own common experience, we look back and perhaps we had an opportunity to say something to someone or to do something or to go somewhere for someone. We didn't take it. And that opportunity may never, ever come again. There may now be barriers. We may never meet the individual again. So the general principle is, while there is the opportunity remaining, do good while you have the opportunity, because we don't know what is going to happen tomorrow and what evil is going to come to prevent us, perhaps, from doing the good that we would. That is the general principle that we have here. And then from verse 3, we are suddenly changing to speak about the clouds. If the clouds be full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth. If the tree fall toward the south or towards the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it shall be. Now, what is the significance of this? Well, if there are clouds, they are full of rain. Sometimes we speak of a dark and a cloudy day. And sometimes we see clouds as those heavy, threatening things. Now, it's undoubtedly true that you can tell if a storm's coming, the clouds get dark, they get that rather dark green, purplish, rather frightening appearance. And we know that a storm is looming. And so, yes, you can tell if there's going to be a bad weather outcome because of the clouds. But also, clouds are a sign that rain is coming. And rain is good. And so when we see a dark and a cloudy day, let us not see it only in terms of danger and disaster. Let us see it in terms of the rain that refreshes the earth. Because while it may well be a storm to us, and it may well blow down trees in our neighborhood, the farmers need it, and someone is benefiting from that flood. And that's the point that we should keep in mind. Maybe we don't enjoy the deluge, But somewhere in the face of the earth there are people who do need that flood. And it could well be that our city sewers just simply need a good clean out. And I'm sure that we all know that when a deluge comes, yes, trees are blown down, but the streets are washed clean. Normally streets in a city and the sewers of a city are absolutely filthy things. And a good shower of water, those engineers who work in the sewers, Andre, they will tell you, they welcome the floods because there's a good clean out, just as we all need cleans out from time to time. And so the clouds that are full of rain, they are a potential for good, not only for evil. So don't see only dark and cloudy days, gloomy times ahead. Rather see the fruitfulness that can come from the rain, how the earth longs to be refreshed by the rain. That's the picture you see. And so what the writer is saying is don't look at life as though it was all sadness and darkness and pessimism. Do good in the midst of an unfair world. See the potential of the clouds. And then he reminds us again of the decisiveness of recognizing that in the clouds there's rain that can do a good thing. Because life is not going to go on and on forever. If the tree falls towards the south or towards the north, in the place where the tree falleth, there it shall be. What does he mean by that? Well, he means that we're all going to fall. We're all like the trees. And once life is over, if we fall this way or if we fall that way, that's it. There's no, just as the tree cannot change direction once it falls, a tree can grow. Trees are, as it were, responsive to chemical and thermal environments. And we know that the plants, they turn towards the sun and so such things. But once there is death, if it falls that way, it's fixed. If it falls the opposite way, it's fixed. You and I, our life and our destiny is fixed. And as we die, so we're going to remain. Those who are righteous still. Those who are filthy still. As the tree falls, so a man falls. As a tree falls, so it shall lie. As a man dies, so he shall also lie. And so what the writer is saying again is nothing remains. The tree is going to remain in the place that it falls because that's the end of it. It's simply decayed. Its life is over and any possibility of fruit bearing for the tree is over and done with and it lies this way or that way, one or the other. And it's the same with you and with me. Our life is the decisive thing and death seals the decisions that we've made in life. And it's too late then to start thinking about doing good and casting our bread upon the water. The opportunities have gone forever. And furthermore, he tells us that we don't know the outcome of everything that we're going to do. He that observeth the wind shall not sow. He that reapeth the clouds shall not reap. As thou knowest not what is the ways of the spirit or how the bones do grow in the womb of her that is with child, even so thou knowest not the works of God who maketh all. In the morning sow thy seed, in the evening withhold not thy hand, for thou knowest not whether shall prosper either this or that, or whether they both shall be alike good. Now here is a picture. We don't know what God's plans are. It's as simple as that. We know what the big picture is, but we don't know what God's plans are. We don't know if our ventures are going to be fruitful or unfruitful. And there's no point in waiting for some special revelation. There is no ideal time. The man who is continually watching for the clouds, he says, or observing the wind, he's never going to do anything. He's too busy observing the signs. The signs of the times. Oh, it's not the right time. It's going to be too windy, or it's not windy enough. We'll wait till the wind dies down, or we'll wait till the wind comes up. Always waiting for a perfect time to do some venture. There is no such thing as a perfect time. We have to take our chances. We don't know. He that observes the wind will never sow. He that regards the clouds, he's never going to reap. Sometimes you have to sow your seed even if there are windy days. You simply have to reap your corn even if there are clouds about. You've just got to do it because it needs to be done. and it needs to be done now. There are no ideal times. There's always something that we can find as an excuse not to do a good thing. Multitudes. It's never time to pray. It's never time to witness. It's never time to do this. It's always never the right time. Congregations make that excuse. We're not in the right locality to witness. It's not the right time. We're not living in the days of the Puritans. We're not living in the days of the... It's not the right time. It's never congenial. Of course it's never congenial. It is never the proper time. It is in season and out of season. Preach the word. It's never the right time, in a sense, for a preacher to be preaching. There's always something that can be a barrier to intimidate and silence the work of the gospel in the world. In the morning, sow your seed, he says. And in the evening, withhold not thy hand, for thou knowest not whether shall prosper either this or that, or whether they both alike shall be good. So what he is saying is this. We have to learn as people living on the face of the earth, but especially as God's people, we have to be prepared to be adventurous. There's a terrible danger that we'll be overcautious. The danger that we will always, as it were, try to, as it were, imagine, well, what if we do that? These are the consequences that will follow. We don't know the consequences. That's the point. We simply don't know. Sometimes people say, well, we can't do this because then they will do that. You do not know what people are going to do. We have no idea. There's no point in saying we can't do this because they'll do that. We have no idea what they're going to do. And if we're going to wait until we know everything that's going to happen in the future, we'll never do anything until the time is right. We don't know any more than we know how the womb is that little receptacle for the mysterious growth of the embryo. We can watch an embryo growing. There are those who take this kind of passage and say, well, this is obviously out of date because we're not. No, we can observe it, but that doesn't mean to say that we know how it happens. We know what happens. Of course we know what happens in the realm of biology. Of course we know what happens. You can watch it. You can watch molecules coming together and dissolving apart again. But that doesn't explain what's happening. It just, you're observing something that you don't know why is it happening. And that's the point. And here the writer is entirely speaking to all generations. There are mysteries in life that are beyond our competence to understand. And if we're going to wait for a perfect understanding of all events working out as we think they should or would wish them to be, then we will never do anything. We have to take risks. We don't need to wait for special revelations. The writer here is saying, get up and start doing it. Do good while you can. And don't be intimidated by uncertainties of the weather or uncertainties of the future. What he's saying is, in the morning, sow your seed. That's the time to sow it. And in the evening, that's another good time to sow it as well. He says, withhold not thy hand, for thou knowest not whether shall prosper, either this or that, or whether they both alike shall be good. So here in these opening six verses, the theme of these verses is do good the best you can with what you've got while you can. Death comes, that fixes the direction of your life, and as you died, so you're going to lie that way. If you were facing the north, that's where you are. If you face the south, that's the way you face. Heaven or hell, these are the issues. And it's too late then to start thinking about trying to do some usefulness. He says you've got to do it. And there's never going to be an absolute certainty whether you will actually succeed or not. You don't know. You have to leave it with God. Because at verse number 5, he says, even so thou knowest not the works of God who maketh all. We don't know what his plans are in the fine detail. So that's what this passage is all about. Then the next verses, 7 to 10, he is telling us, something about life. And he's saying life is not just meant to be endured. He says life is meant to be enjoyed. And this applies to all human life. God gives to us all things richly to enjoy. Notice how he puts it. Truly the light is sweet, and a pleasant thing it is for the eyes to behold the sun. But if a man live many years and rejoice in them all, yet let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. All that cometh is vanity. So not only do the best you can, but make the best in terms of enjoyment with what you've got. If you've got life, enjoy it, because it's not going to last very long. Now, I think there's something really very important here. And that is to recognize that God is not only the giver of life, but the reason that he is the giver of life is that we might enjoy it. Not only that we might come to know him. That's one aspect. Man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him. To enjoy knowing God, and then to get on enjoying the good things that God has given us richly to enjoy. And I am really sick and tired, if I may say so, of certain kinds of Christians trying to hijack the conscience of Christian people living in a land such as Australia, continually reminding us that there are people in this world who don't even have a bed to sleep in. I know there are probably 2/3 of the world's population who don't have beds to sleep in. There are multitudes of millions of people who are hungry, and it's not a question of having 3 meals a day. It's 1 meal in 3 days. And sometimes the idea is put to us, and Christian people do have a tender conscience, that somehow or other we are responsible for that. Well, I can assure you we are not responsible. I am not responsible for the fact that 2/3 of the population don't have beds to sleep in. I'm not responsible for that, and neither are you. Or that there are people in this world starving. That's not my responsibility, nor yours. The responsibility does lie. Certainly, we share a corporate guilt, because we are all greedy. But we have to remember that in the good things of life, the Scripture never, ever, ever condemns riches. We find many people in the Bible who were rich, and there's not one word uttered against them for possessing riches. The Scripture does warn us against the possession of the things of this world, because they can be a danger. And the Bible does warn us against riches more than it warns us against poverty. The Bible's clear on that. But at the same time, it is not part of God's purpose that we should be starving, and that we should be sick for the lack of nourishment and for the lack of proper medication. That's the devil's work. That's not God's work. That's not pleasing to God. That's pleasing to the devil. Death on every hand. Even God does not delight in death. He has no delight in the death of any man. So life is sweet. And if perchance we have been brought up into an environment where we have sufficient nourishment for the body and clothing for the body and liberties and all the benefits, then enjoy those things. And if perchance they are taken from us, well, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away, and blessed be the name of the Lord. Job was never accused by God of being a guilty, sinful man because he was rich. He ends up even richer than he was at the beginning of the book. That is not an accusation leveled against him. There are other accusations leveled against him. But his possessions never captured him. And Job no doubt enjoyed family life. He enjoyed the possessions that he had because they were God's gifts to him. But he also recognized that the God who had given them could take them away from him again. And that's the true caliber of the man. So yes, enjoy life. But remember, it's not going to last forever. Life is sweet. If a man live many years and rejoice in them all, yet let him always remember, this is only brief. Even unto old age, we're not going to live forever. And our eyes are not always going to see the sun. We're not always going to be young and handsome and beautiful and healthy. There are going to be those times, as the preacher tells us in the next chapter, when we're going to decline. We're going to lose our memory, our eyesight, our hearing. Our teeth are going to fall out. We're going to be frightened at our own shadow almost. And that's the way it is. But nonetheless, if we're in that portion and place in life, where life is sweet and light is sweet, then enjoy it. Make the best of it. You will never probably have a happier time. I always remember Lord Hailsham, one of the British high dignitaries, a parliamentarian, a high lawyer. He was the Chancellor, I think, in the British Parliament at one time. He was an old man. He's dead now. But I remember he was a famous peer of the realm. Lord Hailsham. And I remember he was interviewed, and I do recall he was an old man by this time, and I remember the interviewer asking him, what would he say? You know, he'd led a very rich and varied and long life. And was there any portion of life, he said, that was the best time of his life? Without hesitation, he said, yes, when the children were young. I think he's dead right. And those of us who have seen our children grow up through that infancy stage, probably, it is probably the case that the best part of our life is over and done with. That's the best time. Life is sweet. Children are young. We're young. And life is good. Make the most of it, because it's soon going to pass away. And if a man live many years, rejoice in them all, yet let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. This is eternity. Days of darkness. All that cometh is vanity. So the life is meant to be enjoyed and not simply endured. And then the closing verses remind us of the blessings, the particular blessings of youth. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth. Walk in the ways of thy heart and in the sight of thine eyes. But know this, that know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. Therefore remove sorrow from thy heart, put away evil from thy flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. Now here the writer is reminding us not only of the vanity and the brevity, the uncertainty of childhood and youth, but also this is the time when our hearts are to be cheery. Children, let children enjoy their childhood. Let us not bring up our children to responsibilities and solemnities that are beyond their years. I think that there is a kind of strict religion which is entirely unbiblical, and which, as it were, tries to make mature little giants in the Lord out of little children. Everything about our children is childish because they are children. Their faith is immature because they are immature. Children's faith is not of the maturity. It's not able to be of the maturity of mature adults, simply because everything about them is immature. Let them enjoy their little childish faith. There's nothing wrong with childish faith for a child. There is everything wrong with childish faith if, in fact, we have grown up and we are beyond the things of childhood. Let our children develop. Let them develop in understanding at the pace of their growth. Don't expect them to be little geniuses. As soon as they start school, let them start with the ABCs. Let them jump about and enjoy life, because that's the time when life is to be cheerful, according to the scriptures. Let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth. There will be times enough later on in life when there will be evils to contend with, responsibilities to bear, decisions to make, efforts that we've got to endure, big decisions that may have bad consequences. Don't place these upon our children. I'm emphasizing this because in Scottish culture, and in other cultures too, that have a kind of a strong Calvinistic background, there is the idea that if the husband died, that the little boy became the man of the house. And the little boy, perhaps a little less than a teenager, now you're the man of the house. That is a monstrosity. He's not the man of the house. He's a boy. He's a child. The mother, the widow, she is now to be the strong one of the house. And the idea that you put the burden of the house, the little boy, he becomes the man of the house, that is absolute nonsense. A little boy can never be the man of the house. It's as simple as that. It goes against common sense. It also goes against this kind of teaching. So let us not lay burdens upon our children. Let us understand that they will not understand. Let us understand that they will ask questions that may well tax our ability to answer. They may ask questions which are childish, and we may turn with impatience, but that's what they are. They're childish. Let them enjoy life. Let them not be burdened with the burdens of later life. Walk in the ways of thy heart. Now this obviously doesn't mean walk in the ways of sin. It means walk in innocent, childish ways and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things will God will bring thee into judgment. This does not necessarily mean that God's going to condemn you for every smile, for every laughter, or for every joke, or for every happy occasion, or every game that you've had that didn't involve a reading of the Bible. It means that God is going to assess you, because as the boy is, so is the man. Give me the child, says the Jesuits, till he's 7, and we'll give you the man. What a man is in later life, he will be shaping to be. Of course we're to shape our children a certain way, in the same way as we have to prune and shape the plants in our garden to make them grow the way that we want. Of course we've got to shape them. But nonetheless, we don't shape them into a Procrustean bed and make them little clones of some of the great ones of the faith. That's cruelty. That's cruelty. It's unreasonable. And it's entirely unbiblical. God will judge. God will judge our youth as well as our maturity. Therefore, remove sorrow from thy heart. Put away evil from thy flesh. For childhood and youth are vanity. In and of themselves, they're like the wind. They blow away very soon. And those of us who are parents, we can remember when they were born, when they went to school, when they went to high school, when they went to whatever it was they went to. And before we know it, they've reached that age of maturity. We will never be able to influence them for a happy, healthy, wholesome childhood ever again. Young man, young woman, make the most of it while you've got it. God's watching, God's assessing, God's judging, but don't have a sorrowful or a needlessly sorrowful childhood. That's the time to remove sorrow from your heart. And that's the time to learn to put away evil from your flesh. So this is what this chapter is all about. All I've done is just comment and try to bring out the common sense, say, obvious meaning of the texts. And that's what we've tried to do throughout our studies in Ecclesiastes, because Ecclesiastes is a book of practical living. And if we're going to live for life under the sun, then we're going to find in the end it has been a waste of time and a disappointment. And if we're going to find meaning in our brief little vain lives, we have to look somewhere else for meaning and for a true destiny. And so that's what the chapter is about. Do good while you've got the opportunity. Enjoy youth while you've got it, because it doesn't last very long. May God bless his word.